Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back to the show Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. His recent work with April Anderson on queer erasure, how search engines are filtering out pro-LGBTQ stories and amplifying homophobic voices. We'll discuss those topics and the lawsuit against YouTube. We'll have the attorney, Peter Obstler, discuss the First Amendment implications of that case. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of today's program, we are delighted to welcome back Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Andy Lee Roth, of course, is the Associate Director of Project Censored and co-editor with me of Censored 2020, Through the Looking Glass. Andy Roth is a sociologist. His articles and research have appeared in Yes Magazine, scholarly journals, including Media, Culture, and Society, and the International Journal of Press and Politics. Of course, many previous volumes of the Censored Yearbooks from Seven Stories Press. But the reason we have Andy on the show today is that he contributed a chapter to Censored 2020 with April Anderson titled Stonewalled, Establishment Media's Silence on the Trump Administration's Crusade Against LGBTQ People. That book came out last fall, and since then, Andy Lee Roth and April Anderson have written an article called Queer Erasure, published by the Index on Censorship, and it reveals original research showing how search engines are filtering out pro-LGBTQ stories and amplifying homophobic voices. So on today's show, that's the entire theme. Later in the program, we'll have attorney Peter Obstler on, who is on the forefront of the legal battlegrounds around these issues. But right now, welcome back to the show, Andy Lee Roth.
Thanks so much, Mickey. It's a pleasure to join you, as always.
Andy, why don't we start with the recent article? You teamed up once again with April Anderson, who's a library scholar, and you published this piece in the recent issue of Index on Censorship, which is a great publication, by the way. It goes back to the early 1970s. Rachel Jolly and company, we've known them for some time. But Andy, tell us about this article. That'll give us an opportunity to get back into the chapter that you did that led up to this. Tell us about what the theme here is on your recent article with April Anderson, Queer Erasure.
Yeah. The article is called Queer Erasure, and it's really about how some of the most major global media platforms that we rely on for all kinds of communication and information, these major media platforms are basically filtering online speech in ways that marginalize, stigmatize, and endanger LGBTQ communities. And this amounts to almost an international form of censorship, because these media platforms that I'm talking about, Facebook and YouTube and TikTok and others, are bigger in some ways than national governments. A long-term concern for censorship has always involved the power of a national government to gatekeep and filter and propagandize information. But what we're really talking about in a digital age with these global media platforms is the idea that there's a form of censorship that occurs across national boundaries. So it's global in character. And as I say, the focus of my work with April Anderson, my colleague at Macalester College, and a longtime Project Censored contributor, is focused on how this is affecting LGBTQ communities. Our basic finding is that this online filtering is, as I say, marginalizing, stigmatizing, and endangering LGBTQ communities at the same time as the very mechanisms that are accomplishing that negative outcome are also often permitting or even promoting virulent anti-LGBTQ content at the same time. So it's a real double-edged issue that hasn't gotten the kind of attention that we might expect it to.
Well, Andy Lee Roth, part of that seems to me to be that a lot of this research that you're doing with April Anderson is original, and you all are cataloging this. The chapter that you all did for the book, you looked at news coverage of LGBTQ issues. Talk a little bit about what you looked at and how you made your case.
In some ways, the research that April Anderson and I conducted for the Queer Erasure article in the Index on Censorship was prompted by what we found and learned from doing the research that is published in the Censored 2020 volume. But to get into some of the details there, I mentioned a moment ago the idea that there are these major global media platforms that are engaged in systematically marginalizing, stigmatizing, and endangering LGBTQ people and communities. Let me put some detail into that assertion. What April and I began doing was looking at each of these platforms and seeing what were the concerns that were being raised about them and where were those concerns being raised. So, for instance, on Facebook, we found there's been longstanding concerns about what Facebook calls its real name only policy. And real name only policies have good bases for their use. The idea we want to know who we're talking to when we're on Facebook. But Facebook had not been very proactive or effective about how thinking about how real name policies have differential impacts on transgender people. We found Facebook engaged in ad blocking. We found Facebook implementing policies around what it calls protected and unprotected categories. So each of these is an area where, under the guise of addressing hate speech, Facebook has applied these policies that, for instance, prevent transgender people from using their chosen names and identities, that block LGBT content or themes, while at the same time, ironically, treating as protected speech certain categories that promote homophobic or transphobic content. It's not just Facebook. I could say more about other platforms like Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube. So in brief, as April and I began looking at these, we found each one of these by itself doesn't seem like maybe such a big deal, but when you look at them as a whole, it amounts to, in effect, a network of online filtering or, dare we say, censorship. The other factor in this that got us really fired up about writing this most recent piece was the only outlets that we found talking about this were either LGBTQ content providers on YouTube who were making videos about how their content was being blocked, and we can talk more about that, or what April and I found as we were looking was that independent news outlets were reporting on these stories. But we found, and this was utterly consistent with what we found in the Censored 2020 chapters, the corporate news media, the so-called establishment press, have basically had nothing to say about these issues. So there's a double censorship at work here. There's the actual censorship or filtering of LGBTQ content online. And then in terms of a wider public's awareness of what's happening, there's a second layer of censorship, which is that the corporate establishment press have simply been, by and large, with a few exceptions that I could note, have essentially been silent on this process.
So in other words, when the corporate media do rarely cover this, they cover it through a certain frame.
Well, it doesn't get covered much. So that the online censorship that the Index on Censorship article is about, we found almost no establishment coverage of this. The one article that we found that seemed pertinent, the Washington Post in October of 2018 ran in their technology section an ad about Facebook's involvement in so-called ad blocking, where ads that Facebook deems to be problematic get blocked. The Washington Post article was addressing both the blocking and how LGBT groups were responding, organizing in response to that blocking. But other than that, all the coverage that we found were from what for many people would be so-called alternative publications. So everything from like The Verge and The Guardian to Vox, and then outlets like Gay Times, The Daily Dot, Out, and other news outlets that focus specifically on LGBTQ issues.
You mentioned, too, the multiple ways that online technologies have been erasing this kind of content, and worse, demonizing LGBTQ communities. You mentioned five ways that you've seen this going on through Google News, through Google's aggregator, keyword blacklists. You mentioned Tumblr's ban on adult content, dating apps, and of course, a lawsuit going on against YouTube that we'll get into later on. Say a little bit about those specific areas or how that's affecting this.
The Google News study is something that April and I were inspired to do by one of these independent news articles that we came across a guy named Matt Tracy at Gay City News in New York last October did just a kind of informal study of Google News, where for a week, Matt Tracy looked at Google News for all the top 10 news items that Google News was returning if you did a search using the Google News aggregator on the terms LGBT as a search and related terms. And so Tracy did this study back last fall and found that the Google News results for those searches was producing all this conservative, often evangelical Christian perspectives on LGBT issues. And so he wrote an article about that that April and I came across in our research. And we thought, let's replicate that study. Let's see if what was true back in the fall when Matt Tracy conducted his study remains true today. And what we found was pretty surprising. We replicated Tracy's study in February of this year. And after a week of looking at LGBTQ stories that were highlighted by the Google News aggregator, we found that 46% of those stories came from conservative outlets, including nearly a third of those came from conservative Christian sources that wouldn't normally show up as, in effect, news organizations in the first place. And despite there being an abundance of excellent news outlets that are dedicated to reporting LGBTQ issues, during the entire week that we were looking at these search terms, Google News didn't feature a single one of those outlets among its reporting. We were pretty surprised by this, and we thought, well, maybe this is just how search engines on the internet work. So we ran the same study the same week using a different news aggregator, the DuckDuckGo news aggregator, and we found dramatically different results. We found basically that just 6% of DuckDuckGo's LGBTQ articles came from conservative, religious, or political sources, and a lot more than 56% of DuckDuckGo's LGBTQ stories came from what you might consider mainstream U.S. news sources, and another 13% came from international news sources that I think by almost anybody's standards would be considered mainstream. So what to conclude from this finding? Of course, and this is something you'll be addressing later in the program, Google's algorithms are proprietary. They're not available for public scrutiny. So it's impossible to make a judgment at the present time about whether the prominence of anti-LGBTQ news stories in Google News is the result of biases that are built into Google's algorithms, whether it's the result of skillful search engine optimization by conservatives who have homophobic agendas or some combination of those. We can't really determine that. But either way, one of the points that April and I made and feel is important for people to understand is that when you read about Google and Google News, Google touts that its service provides the most reliable results. It basically says this is trustworthy. The language they use on their website describing the Google search engine is that the articles that are returned, quote, demonstrate expertise, authoritativeness, and trustworthiness on a given topic. And yet what we found in our study and what Matt Tracy had previously found was that Google was consistently returning news stories about LGBTQ issues that reflected extreme biases, and that, as Matt Tracy pointed out in an interview we conducted with him, that didn't seem to reflect mainstream attitudes in the United States about LGBTQ communities or issues at all.
That's a pretty riveting finding. And again, I just want to remind all of our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On the line, we have Associate Director, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He's co-editor with me of Censored 2020 Through the Looking Glass. We're talking about a recent article that Andy Roth wrote with librarian and researcher April Anderson. It is in this month's issue of the Index on Censorship's publication. The article's titled Queer Erasure, and we're talking about how search engines are filtering out pro-LGBTQ stories and amplifying homophobic voices. We'll continue our conversation with Andy Lee Roth after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this episode of the Project Censored Show, we're talking about censorship of LGBTQ issues. We have as our guest today the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He's co-editor of the Censored Annual Volumes, co-edited with me, out on Seven Stories Press. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. Andy Roth, also a sociologist, and has been working in both the Censored 2020 book and the spring issue of Index on Censorship. He's been working with library scholar April Anderson on issues about how algorithms and search engines are filtering out pro-LGBTQ stories and amplifying homophobic voices. His article with April Anderson is entitled Queer Erasure. Also, Andy co-authored a chapter 7, with April Anderson called Stonewalled, Establishment Media's Silence on the Trump Administration's Crusade Against LGBTQ People. So, Andy Roth, before the break, you were explaining to us about how Google's algorithms seem to be filtering out these stories versus DuckDuckGo. And again, I do urge listeners to check out the new article, Queer Erasure and Index on Censorship. Also, check out Chapter 7 in Project Censored. By the way, that article is online at our website, projectcensored.org. Andy Roth, why don't we go back a little bit and talk about some of the findings you saw in the article Stonewalled, and you were talking about the establishment media silence on the Trump administration's policies against LGBTQ people.
In the Stonewalled article, whereas the Queer Erasure article, April and I were focusing on online content, the Stonewalled article, which is the first major piece that April and I collaborated on, we were looking at newspaper coverage. And the study was really motivated by two observations. The first being that over the last couple of years, the Trump administration has really been engaged in what can be described without, I think, hyperbole as a crusade against LGBTQ people. We've seen the Trump administration rescind key protections for transgender students. Trump has appointed two anti-equality judges to the Supreme Court. There's, of course, the ban of transgender troops from serving openly in the military. And then most threatening right now is how, under the guise of so-called religious liberty, the Trump administration is pursuing policies that open the door to discrimination in all walks of life against LGBTQ people. So discrimination in the workplace, discrimination in healthcare, discrimination in housing and other public accommodations. So one component of the story was a sense that there's a rollback of a number of gains that had been made under the Obama administration. At the same time, though, what April and I were tracking was that news coverage of this rollback seemed to be conspicuously absent. There was a study in September of last year by Real Clear Politics that concluded that in television news, coverage of LGBTQ issues had all but disappeared since Trump took office. So we began, April and I began, looking at all the news coverage we could find in major newspapers published between January 2016, when the Trump administration took office, up to November of 2018, when the midterm elections took place. And the basic finding that we had after looking at hundreds of articles and thousands of quotations in those articles is that the corporate news has effectively muted, marginalized, or ignored the steady rollback of LGBTQ rights under the Trump administration. I can go into some more detail about some positive and some negative findings related to that.
One of the things that you address, something that we talk about a lot at Project Censored, who's newsworthy, who achieves media standing. You also talk about a significant lack of diversity in corporate media. Talk about what you and April Anderson found.
We did have one positive finding, and it relates directly to that concept you mentioned, Mickey, of media standing, which is a concept we have from the sociologist William Gamson, who uses the term media standing to talk specifically about who's treated as a newsworthy actor, a person who's engaged in newsworthy action, or a newsworthy commentator, someone whose insights and observations on a given issue are treated as relevant. And so using Gamson's concept of media standing, April and I looked at over 1,000 direct quotes that were included in these news articles we looked at over that 2-year period. One of our findings, a positive finding, was that news, corporate news, major newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, are increasingly centering LGBTQ voices, giving LGBTQ people status as newsworthy people in their own right. In other words, they're people who are speaking as and on behalf of newsworthy topics, rather than as in the past. If we look historically at news coverage of LGBTQ issues and people, they would be talked about rather than being centered as actors and informed experts themselves. So we found that somewhere between 7 and 8% of the direct quotes in our database were attributed to people who were explicitly identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender by the news report itself. And that figure is actually somewhat higher than recent estimates of the overall LGBTQ population in the United States as a whole. We drew there on statistics from the very reputable Williamson Institute at UCLA. So we took that as a positive finding in the sense that the message has gotten out to establishment newspaper journalists and editors that LGBTQ people and communities have important perspectives, are newsworthy actors, and sources of relevant information and opinion. We were pleasantly surprised by the diversity in terms of media standing, who's quoted. We were less encouraged by the narrow focus of the corporate media coverage we looked at, which essentially during the time period we were looking at, January 2016 through November of 2018, as I noted, basically there were two stories that the corporate news media focused on in that time. One was Trump's proposed ban of transgender people from the military. The other major topic were stories about state and local efforts to rescind so-called bathroom bills, which is the prejudicial term, a term that was initially coined by the far right to refer to these non-discrimination laws that would help protect transgender people, especially in public settings. But the term bathroom bills, which was, as I say, a term introduced by people on the far right to incite fear, panic, and opposition, was a term that was frequently used in the stories that we found. So a couple of problems here. One is a fairly narrow focus, and then within that narrow focus, a framing of at least one of those issues in a way that basically played to the homophobic perspectives of one set of stakeholders on that issue, a kind of conservative right perspective on these non-discrimination laws. And that contrasted what we found in the establishment media, contrasted significantly with what we found when we looked at equivalent coverage in independent news outlets, where we found a much wider range of issues and perspectives, whereas there was almost nothing in the corporate news coverage that we looked at about health policy or employment issues. We found articles in the independent media on LGBTQ issues as those topics were related. And then we also found a kind of historical perspective on things like the non-discrimination laws, the so-called bathroom bills. In the independent news media, we found that many times the non-discrimination laws to protect transgender people were understood and framed in terms of the history of the civil rights movement and the racial integration, for instance, of the military by President Truman in 1948, or the desegregation of schools in 1950, Brown v. Board of Education. So rather than framing it as bathroom bills to keep people from being harassed in bathrooms, a frame that incites fear, panic, and opposition, independent news media were framing these issues historically in the context of a ongoing but expanding civil rights movement.
So Andy Lee Roth, what you're describing here sounds like a concerted effort institutionally among the corporate media. And of course, in your article with April Anderson, Stonewalled, the Trump administration and its policies really marginalize LGBTQ communities. And this, of course, URU has an extraordinarily detrimental effect, particularly on civil rights issues.
I think that's exactly right. And maybe the most egregious version of that that April and I documented is what we've come to call the Perkins effect. Tony Perkins is, of course, the leader of the Family Research Council, which officially advocates policies based on fundamentalist Christian worldview, but in practice has been basically a homophobic and transphobic force in the public sphere to the extent that the Southern Poverty Law Center categorized the Family Research Council as a hate group based on its anti-LGBTQ positions. So when they talk about the Tony Perkins effect, what April and I are describing is how in the establishment news media, we found what we describe as kind of a whitewashing of the most virulent homophobic and transphobic perspectives. We started paying attention to Tony Perkins because he's frequently quoted in papers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. So at first it was just a matter of, gosh, there's another quote for Tony Perkins in our study of media standing. But then we started looking at the content, the substance of what Perkins was saying when he was quoted in, say, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. And what we found was that Perkins was quoted and he was framed as basically a fair partisan engaged in a legitimate debate about issues like whether transgender people can serve in the military without compromising the military's mission, or why parents don't have a right to have bathrooms be only for males defined in terms of biology and genitalia rather than social identity. And so Perkins would appear in these articles. There would be no mention in the Times coverage that the Southern Poverty Law Center in 2010 had identified Perkins' organization, the Family Research Council, as a hate group based on its hateful public statements. And there would be no mention of Perkins' more virulent homophobic statements made in other settings. So this is what we mean by kind of a whitewashing. So, for instance, if you look at The Advocate, an independent publication that focuses on LGBTQ issues, including culture and news and so forth, The Advocate will run articles where they will quote Perkins at his most virulent, Perkins and other figures like him. And so one of the dilemmas that April and I raise, we don't have, I think, a pat simple answer to this question, but one of the dilemmas that we raise in the Censored 2020 chapter about this topic is, what should journalists and editors do? On one hand, if you report news that omits these expressions of extreme prejudice, you in some sense normalize people like Tony Perkins. He comes off seeming like a reasonable person. On the other hand, of course, if you publish these expressions of extreme prejudice, that's not an easy option either, because you're now involved in the business of circulating these terrible homophobic, transphobic viewpoints. So I think one of the points that April and I make, and that unfortunately hasn't come true since the book came out, since the chapter came out, is there ought to be a wider public discussion about how to handle this. It's a wider public discussion that ought to involve editors and journalists at newspapers and other news organizations. And it's also a wider public discussion that ought to involve us, the public. And until we have those kinds of discussion, I think how to cover these issues remains truly a dilemma. I'm not advocating the whitewashing of Tony Perkins, the Family Research Council, or the terrible things he consistently says about LGBTQ people and communities. But I think we need to come up with a way to cover those issues that call Perkins and his statements for what they are, without necessarily providing a platform to amplify those virulent views. And that's a challenge.
Absolutely. It's an ongoing challenge and part of the responsibility of a free press to not just have these people out there in false equivalency fashion or the objectivity bias of, well, now we heard from the other side. As you and April Anderson point out, great harm caused by people that are allowed to just freely say these things and they're not called out. The corporate press doesn't seem to investigate further, or they don't contextualize the comments in the long view of civil rights matters, like you said that you and April Anderson found that the independent press has long done. We're unfortunately out of time for this segment. I just wanted to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. For this segment, we've been talking to Andy Lee Roth. He's the associate director of Project Censored. He's co-author of a chapter in the 2020 book called Stonewalled, Establishment Media Silence on Trump Administration's Crusade Against LGBTQ People. He's also co-author with April Anderson of a recent article in the Index on Censorship. It's the spring edition of the Index on Censorship. The article is called Queer Erasure, and it talks about how search engines are filtering out pro-LGBTQ stories while amplifying homophobic voices. Andy Lee Roth, thank you so much for joining us on this segment of the Project Censored Show. today to talk about this very important and ongoing issue.
Thank you, Mickey.
Up next on the program, we're joined by attorney Peter Obstler, who is involved in a lawsuit against one of these big tech firms. And we're going to get into the nitty-gritty about that after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are continuing with our theme. We were just speaking with Andy Lee Roth about his article, Queer Erasure, in the new issue of Index on Censorship. And right now, we're going to get more specific about the topic. We have on the line with us Peter Obstler of Brown George Ross, a partner in the firm's litigation department. Peter Obstler has more than 20 years' experience representing public entities, corporations, privately held institutions, and individual clients in complex, high-stakes adversarial proceedings. He's appeared on behalf of his clients in jury and bench trials in state and federal courts and the California Supreme Court. He is the attorney in a lawsuit brought by LGBTQ content creators against YouTube. And in the last segment, you heard Andy Roth and I talking about a lot of censorship going on and algorithmic problems going on over at Google and YouTube. And right now, we have the legal expert on the line, Peter Obstler, to tell us more about some of the curiosities of this case. Peter Obstler, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you talk to our listeners about what this case is?
Certainly. About 18 months ago, I received a call from two individuals who worked at content creation or news organization called GNews. They do news for the LGBTQ community in San Francisco, including current events. And they spoke to me about a situation in which they had attempted to purchase an ad from YouTube to promote their video for a Christmas special they were doing on YouTube for activities for LGBTQ people on Christmas Eve. They informed me during that conversation that after several weeks in early January, they realized that the ad had not run, even though they had paid for it. And when they began to cut through the YouTube bureaucracy to try to find out why not, they ultimately were transferred to someone who identified himself as a senior content creator who actually was based in Bangalore, India. And he informed my clients in a tape-recorded phone call that the algorithm that Google and YouTube used to regulate content on YouTube had flagged the video that they sought to seek an ad for as sexually explicit, shocking, and inappropriate. When my client asked him what in the video, which involved a Christmas special that talked about things like even church services and things like that, that LGBTQ people could go to on Christmas Eve, when my client asked what in that content was sexually explicit or otherwise violated YouTube rules, the individual didn't know, and he said, I have to go back and look at the video. And he went back and looked at the video several times, and then he came back, and he apparently concluded, or at least he said, and this is what he said, that it was sexually explicit, not because of the content, but because my client was gay and identified as LGBTQ. And when my client said, so are you discriminating against me because I'm gay rather than because there's anything wrong with my content, he said, no, sir, I'm not discriminating against you. This is company policy. So with that allegation and that concern, we began to investigate. And lo and behold, we put together a coalition of plaintiffs, a couple of whom actually had been involved in meetings with YouTube going back to August of 2017, where this same complaint that is identifying people as gay or LGBTQ or even black is used as the basis for denying access to the site or restricting the content rather than the content itself, we began to understand that YouTube and Google were engaged in a form of content regulation that didn't look at content at all, but used the data and the metadata that they got from the users to identify their race and sex and their competitive position in the market, and then used that to make their decisions as to whether to restrict access, restrict advertising, demonetize the channels. And effectively, what we are alleging is that all of YouTube's content regulation is not, in fact, based on viewpoint-neutral application of what we call content-based rules to actual underlying video content, but is based, at least in part, if not in full, on the user's personal racial, sexual, or commercial identity. This, in turn, of course, allows defendants, and particularly Google, who's become the major content creator, as well as the content regulator on YouTube, to use discriminatory content regulation to advance its own political, discriminatory, and most importantly, competitive interests on YouTube in direct violation of its terms of service with users and the anti-discrimination laws of California and the United States. We also picked up on a theme that has frankly been a tough haul for us, but we still believe that we are right, that given the size of YouTube, i.e. that it controls 95% of all the public video content in the world, that YouTube is involved in what is known as an essential government function, that is, the regulation of free speech in an open public forum subject only to content-based rules and regulations. And therefore, we also have a claim. It's not the only claim, but it's one of I think, 9 claims that we have in the case, claiming that that plus their use of an immunity statute to assert immunity from claims of discrimination renders them what is known as a state actor or quasi-government entity, and therefore the First Amendment and the United States Constitution, at least with respect to the First Amendment, applies to their content regulation conduct.
The last part of what you said seems to have wide-reaching implications, particularly for these other social media platforms. Would you argue that's also the case?
Google and YouTube think it's an existential crisis. The courts have been very reluctant and slow to gravitate to this. I've litigated this issue now once and lost, both at the district court and the court of appeal. The First Amendment makes clear that the government shall make no law that abridges the right to freedom of speech, association, and expression. YouTube is not the government. YouTube is arguing that they're a private company and they hold private title to YouTube, and therefore the United States Constitution, at least with respect to the First Amendment, does not apply because that provision applies only to governments. In 1946, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Marsh versus Alabama. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court held that the First Amendment applied to a private property owner because the private property owner was operating a company town. Remember the old company towns that used to exist?
Yeah.
And held that because the private party was in fact functioning in areas that had been traditionally reserved for the government, i.e. administering a town where people lived, they were the functional equivalent of the government, and therefore they were subject to the First Amendment. Now, Marsh was applied several years afterwards to shopping centers, that is to public areas where the private property owner opens his property to the public. One of the early progenies to Marsh held that, in fact, the shopping center was a public forum. This issue has been lurking in the courts for 50 or 60 years, mostly being litigated in the context of cable public access television networks. And it came to a head last year when the United States Supreme Court, in one of Justice Kavanaugh's first opinions, decided a case called Manhattan Cable Company versus Halleck. In that case, the plaintiff claimed that a state law requiring that people be given public access to certain television stations at certain times at night as part of the right of a private company to operate a private cable network, made the private company a state actor or government when it came to regulating speech in that public space, i.e. the public access channel, even though the channel was owned by a private property. The Second Circuit, in a very excellent opinion by a former Chief Judge John O. Newman, who I personally believe to be the single most brilliant First Amendment and, in fact, American jurist and First Amendment jurisprudence in the United States, concluded that, in fact, yes, the opening of the public access channel to the public did, at least with respect to regulation on that channel at that time, subject the private party to the constraints of the First Amendment when it was regulating speech. The cable company, the private defendant in that case, appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and Justice Kavanaugh reversed and said that merely opening your property for public discourse does not, by that fact alone, and that's the key line, by that fact alone, make you a government actor. Because if that were the case, everybody and anybody who invited the public on to their property would become a state actor, and that would make it absolutely unworkable, and that was not the point of the First Amendment. In the context of that case, we argued that YouTube was different because it wasn't just the fact that YouTube invites the public to use the site. If you look at YouTube's mission statement, they officially and formally designate the property as a public forum for freedom of expression, and they confirmed that in sworn testimony before Congress in the Senate Communications Committee, where when they were asked, is YouTube a public fora, they said yes, and they said they operate it pursuant to viewpoint-neutral and identity-neutral content-based rules that apply equally to everyone, which is effectively the underpinnings of the First Amendment, okay? The First Amendment is often referred to as an amendment that says anything goes, and that's just completely not true. The First Amendment is very clear that not everything goes. All the First Amendment does is it sets up a hierarchy for determining when the person who's regulating the speech has done so for reasons that are based on viewpoint and identity rather than on the content of the speech, which is a pretty common sense concept. If somebody says, you know, for lack of a word, F you and you're a blah, 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 yeah, that speech can be regulated and censored. But if somebody says, let's go Mets, but they happen to be black or gay, and you're really censoring them because they're black or gay, not because of what they said, but you are using the content-based rule as a pretext to make up a reason for taking them down, the courts have said that if you're a government, that violates the First Amendment. And so when looking at YouTube's criteria, we became concerned that the criteria was so vague in general, i.e. anything that YouTube says is otherwise objectionable in its discretion, that it could be used as a pretext to take competitors and or racial minorities or the LGBT community off the platform or certainly hurt them with respect to the ability to get equal access to a platform that they promise is available equally to all as long as you abide by the content-based rules.
Certainly a fascinating case. I want to hold on a moment and remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We have on the line attorney Peter Obstler. He's the lead attorney for plaintiffs in a case against YouTube. After this brief musical break, we're going to return to that conversation and learn more about the case. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are joined by attorney Peter Obstler of Brown George Ross. He's the lead attorney for plaintiffs in a case against YouTube, a lawsuit brought by LGBTQ content creators against YouTube for violating their First Amendment rights, their expression rights. Before the break, Peter Obstler, you gave us a great crash course history in some of First Amendment issues. Thank you so much for providing our listeners with that context and then bringing it up to the case that you're currently involved in. Just before the break, you were talking about how by YouTube's own mission statement, by their own language, you're arguing that they are censoring on the basis of who is saying something. Could you talk to our listeners a little bit about what is YouTube arguing when you went to them and you said, hey, you seem to be discriminating against these people on the basis of content? How did that go?
YouTube has argued in the courts that they're a private party and that they are not only not subject to First Amendment laws, but they're also immune from any type of discrimination, anti-competitive consumer fraud, and even contract-based breaches of law because they're an internet service provider and they can avail themselves of the immunity provided by Congress for internet startups known as Section 230C of the Community Decency Act, which provides immunity for internet service providers who regulate and filter speech or who act effectively as a publisher in making functional editorial decisions. They claim that our claims all derive from content curation and regulation, and therefore, in addition to the fact that they're a private party and are not a First Amendment defendant, as we discussed, they're arguing they're immune from liability for state tort laws, the UNRU Act in California that prohibits discrimination against African Americans, and LGBTQ persons in contract and business, and even state constitutional laws that clearly hold that private parties are subject to freedom of speech and liberty of speech constitutional protections under California law because they operate places where they invite the public. But they're claiming that all of those claims are barred as a matter of law, which means that they need to be dismissed before any discovery takes place simply because Congress granted internet service providers who regulate content immunity from decisions that relate to the decision as to whether to filter, restrict, or otherwise edit a user's content.
So where are you in the case right now?
The court has not made any rulings in this case. We are in the process of briefing initial issues. YouTube has moved to dismiss the case on the immunity grounds that we discussed, on the grounds that they're a private party, and on the grounds that really their terms of service permits them to discriminate against people based on sex and race. YouTube cannot, at this stage of the litigation, dispute the facts that we allege, because at this stage of the litigation, nobody's had an opportunity to do discovery. For example, we have not been given the computer code to the algorithm. If that code shows they're doing exactly what they're saying they're doing, then one would think YouTube would have a pretty big problem. But of course, they don't want to give us that code. No one's ever seen the code, and they don't want to let us take depositions, that is, interviews under oath of the person who told my client that there was a company policy against gay people. They don't want to let us interview their engineers, because they're claiming that they're immune from suit, which is effectively saying it doesn't matter that we're doing this. We admit we're doing it for purposes of legally, you know, for the purposes of the motion. We admit we're doing it, but even if we're doing it, we're immune. That's their argument. And or that their terms of service permit them to do exactly what we're saying they're doing. So there's no dispute at this point in the litigation that they are doing what we claim they're doing. But what they are claiming is that Congress made them immune, unlike other private companies, because they're an internet service provider, and that because the discrimination is taking place in the context of content filtering and regulation on YouTube, the immunity applies. Our response to that is, it is absolutely constitutionally impermissible for the United States government to pass a law that allows a private party to discriminate based on race or sex in contract against another private party in a business and not allow that party to sue for violation of the contract or other anti-competitive laws in that process solely because the person bringing the lawsuit is a racial minority. We would argue that the use of a federal law by a federal court to dismiss that type of a claim operate is state action. In other words, now we do have the government involved, right? Because now we have the legislature, Congress, and the courts using a law to prevent my clients from being able to get a fair and full opportunity to prove their case of discrimination against YouTube. We would argue that that law, if it would be applied that way and they would be granted immunity for this type of discrimination, would operate as an unconstitutional prior restraint on my client's right to petition the courts for legal relief for clearly alleged and well-pleaded violations of state and federal law. Everybody has the right to go to court, and the fact that my clients are going to court because of racial and sexual discrimination makes it even more imperative and less likely that Congress intended a statute that was supposed to be based on actually reviewing content to apply to people who don't really review content. They only review people, or they only filter people. So we're making two arguments. The first is that if you read the plain text of the statute, it relates to the filtering of content. It doesn't mention the filtering of people, and therefore the immunity would not apply to allegations that you're not looking at content, or if you are looking at content, you're looking at content only in the context of the racial or sexual or competitive identity of the person who made the statement, not the actual underlying content. And our second argument is that if the court were to say that, no, we think that Congress intended to also immunize discrimination, even if it wasn't based on the actual content, but was based on who was saying it, but that it was done in the context of content regulation by name, then we would operate that that law is unconstitutional as applied and that it violates the First Amendment right to petition the courts and operates as a prior restraint on speech against minorities who are then also being denied equal protection of the law because, of course, other people who aren't being censored don't have this problem because they're not gay or black. This would be like if a law were passed that said, yeah, you can't discriminate against somebody unless you're a private party, in which case you can use a federal law to stop people from suing you. We would argue that the passing of that law and the application of that law to allow a court to dismiss that case is clearly government action and is subject to the constraints of the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, and would clearly violate court orders that have been held to be prior restraints on the right of a party to petition. By prior restraint, we mean a restraint that is issued before anybody has looked at the merits of the specific allegations of the conduct. And in this case, it operates not merely as a prior restraint on speech, but it kicks my clients out of court and says, if you're black or gay and YouTube has discriminated against you in its content filtering because of your race or sex, you cannot go to the courts. The courts are closed. I would argue that that's unconstitutional.
Well, Peter Obstler, it is the case too, at these major tech firms and social media platforms, there's a lot of AI or algorithmic kind of filtering going on, but that technology is created by someone.
That's correct. Our theory of the case is that the amount of content that YouTube is regulating is so vast, something to the effect of more content comes up in an hour than the entire major television networks have produced in 20 years. They've got 2.3 billion users. They're regulating 95.5% of all the video content that exists in the world. They clearly can't do that by human review, so they try to use a machine, an algorithm that looks at everything. We believe that the code in the algorithm is looking at that content by identifying and using the data that people give to their race, their sex, not what they're saying, and that becomes the basis for the machine's decision. And then the human people come in on the back end after the machine has made the decision and try to justify the decision based on these sort of vague criteria. But my clients, for example, put out a video about tea, whether green tea or black tea was preferable for relieving stress. And because the metadata had LGBTQ content creator having issued the thing, it was restricted as inappropriate for sensitive audiences. My clients, Bria and Chrissy, were demonetized, ostensibly for content that violated their rules. YouTube has since said they made a mistake and that was inadvertent. But the question becomes, why did they make that mistake and pick on Chrissy and Bria? Obviously, if their content was compliant, the machine was doing something else. It was looking at something else. We have been told by engineers the code in the machine is unbelievably dirty. We've been told that it's anti-competitive, so that it identifies the competitive aspect of the user, as well as the racial and sexual identities, the religious identities. Look, conservatives are being victimized by this. I represent Prager University. They had a video on the Ten Commandments, restricted. Why? Apparently, it was considered violent. If they were doing this to everybody, that's fine. At the same time they're doing this, they are sponsoring and monetizing homophobic and racial hate speech that then is filtered onto my clients' channels and drives viewers away because they don't want to be subject to that. I have a client who does videos for children of LGBTQ parents and does videos about schools and things like that. Her channel has been flooded with homophobic hate speech that apparently is not being filtered by Google for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And that drives viewers away. And she has emails from parents who say, we love your channel, but we can't go there anymore. This hate speech is horrible. And then we get Google and YouTube coming out and saying, yeah, we don't agree with the hate speech, but people have a First Amendment right to do that. And then at the same time, they turn around and tell my clients they don't have a First Amendment right. And yeah. I just hope that the courts are going to wake up and finally smell the coffee here. We have a hearing set for May 12th. Based on what the Justice Department does, we would go to hearing on May 12th. Whether that will be done telephonically or the hearing will be canceled, we don't know. We would expect a decision absent more problems with COVID and the other problems that the courts have had in the midsummer as to whether we can pursue this case.
Peter Obstler, this is a fascinating case. Sounds like it has extremely far-reaching implications. Thank you so much for your very important work. Peter Obstler is lead attorney for plaintiffs suing YouTube, and Peter Obstler is with the law firm Brown, George, and Ross. Peter Obstler, when the case goes through, we'd love to have you back on the program.
Mickey, it's a pleasure, and I'd like to tell all your listeners we're doing everything we can to try to get a look at that algorithm, and I would like to tell everybody that we're not in this simply to win a lawsuit, although that is what our clients have hired us for. And by that, I mean, if we look at that code and we determine that that code is clean, we will withdraw this lawsuit. But my guess is that it's riveted with anti-competitive data. And so we are greatly looking forward to the opportunity, and we hope the court will give it to us to at least take discovery as to what's in the algorithm and interview the individuals who told my clients that Google and YouTube had a policy that their content did not meet their requirements solely because they, not their content, were gay.
We will certainly be watching this case very closely through the summer. Thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
My pleasure, and thank you for having us, Mickey.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.